Hello and welcome to Prime Lenses. I'm Ian. Each week I speak to a photographer about three lenses that have meant something to them on their photographic journey. It's unashamedly gear chat, but hopefully focused more on the images made with that gear than performance metrics and graphs. My guest today is Matthias Berling. He's worked in media production since around 2007, and experience in production, video and stills made a YouTube channel about photography and natural fit. Since then, he's published over 420 videos in over 10 years, and for me, he's one of photography's permanent fixtures. I often watch his videos as I really trust his no-nonsense approach to technology, not to mention his fantastic eye. His images are stunning, dynamic, and beautiful. Just before I interviewed him, I was in Sweden, and we realised too late how geographically close to one another we actually were. Alas, an in-person meeting will have to wait, but I'm sure I'll be back soon. And in the meantime, we can all settle for enjoying this conversation over the internet. Here is Matthias. If people then after this, if they don't know your stuff already and they come to your videos and like, oh, that sounds a lot better, then they'll just blame me. It'll be all right.
I think it's It'll a sickness be okay. Because I started in radio. So for me, it's kind of important, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, radio, I was really excited to read about some of your background stuff because my probably first love as a consumer of things, not making it, but as a consumer of things was radio, because I think radio is, it's very personal. Like Julian Pasternak, who I interviewed earlier in the series, talked about like the how once you're in people's ears, that's quite, you're quite close. That's quite, you know, it's quite a nice sort of, they're letting you in a way that TV doesn't, you know?
No, but podcasts does, you know. It's very, but the thing with radio, but podcast does this too. Also, but it was also something about you listening in the car or something. Like they came along with you on your journey to, let's say, you're going to your, whatever, you're going on a trip and they tagged along with you.
And it cool. ties the memory, doesn't it, of listening to it. Like there were podcasts that I listened to that ran the length and then ended. And I remember where I was when they ended, like when those people were having those last conversations and they knew it was the last episode and they were saying goodbye effectively. And I remember where I was. And similarly, yesterday I met with a friend who reviewed the show and liked the show and was like, we were on a trip and we were doing this. And I think he'll always remember like my voice was coming along with them in a funny way.
And then when I was a kid, we used to go to, we had a cabin basically in Finland where my family's from, and no TV or anything. So there's really not much to do at night. But then we listened to like the late night radio from Sweden because we got Swedish reception across the Baltic Sea. And it was 1 hour ahead in Finland. So it's usually pretty darn late as well. So it was all dark, you had a fire going, and you listen to those late night type of shows where people phone in and talk about, you know, maybe something that's stressing them or blah, blah, blah. And beats TV in my book, you know, for pure entertainment. Like,
isn't there that thing that people say as well, that like radio is the most visual medium because you're kind of like, you're doing it all in your head.
Yeah. If radio like catches you, it's going to give you more than TV. Like if you stop everything to listen to this, that's going to be stick with you and, like touch you more than a good episode of something.
Yeah. So if your first love, I guess, was radio, what kind of, what was it that attracted you to photography, I guess? Because it's obviously a completely different, very visual medium, you know, like if you start over here.
No, but as a kid, I like played with cameras and I had a toy camera, like that didn't shoot anything. Like it was a pretend camera. And one of my first images, I have it somewhere on my Instagram, is I claim that's the first picture I ever took. And then I'm sitting on the stairs, I think in Venice or something, we're on a trip with my family. And then I have that pretend camera that's just a pretend camera. And I tell my dad, like, take a picture of me at the same time. So I'm like three. I'm taking a picture of you. That way, like, I took the picture. And when I see that as an adult, it's true. I'm surely the photographer in that situation. He's basically a tripod.
That's amazing. I love that story. That's such a wonderful way of looking at it. Yeah, you're right. You are the photographer.
Yeah, and that picture is obviously one of my favorites. I mean, it's awesome. And I remember it so clearly. And it's an early memory as well. But then I guess later on, like I had a camera and play with, but I mean, it was expensive with film. It's not like I was given the opportunity to take. It was like, okay, on this trip or whatever, you get one role and that's it. If digital would have been around, then definitely I would have started photography earlier. Financial reasons. But then what happened was I did other stuff and I went to high school in the States. And I didn't really care about photography then. And I did join the army, didn't care. And then I started to become a journalist. So I went to university to be a journalist. And there I immediately gravitated towards radio and TV production. And then we started using video cameras. So that's probably where I learned like light composition, that sort of thing. And basic photography as a news reporter, like how to take a portrait and how to take like a document. This is the place I'm writing about. Nothing creative, really. Just get it done type of thing. And then that's when I actually bought my first DSLR, which was the Canon 300D, which I reviewed like a year ago, maybe, like a revival type of thing.
Right, going back to it.
Yeah, and I used that. And I used that for work, like an internship at a paper, and I had like really nice images printed. But I still didn't care about photography. And then when I look at those images, they're really cool because they are of me. I went on an assignment where I did a piece on a friend's dad who is like, when you're going to one of our bigger steel harbors here in the archipelago, he's the guy that comes out and takes you into shore because the tanker ship or whatever that comes from England or something, he's gonna hit an island if he tries to go in. Like, you need to know your way. So I went with him, and we went out on an icebreaker, and then he was like, "You can tag along." And we jumped, like the boat went up against an oil tanker, and we went like this, and it's 10 centimeters of ice, and we jumped and grabbed like a rope ladder and up against this. And I have pictures of this, all taken with the 300D. And I still didn't care about photography.
It's amazing. So you were just in this incredible setting.
Yeah.
And then, but you're capturing pictures. I suppose you're there to do a job.
I think I had it in probably in full auto, the camera. And just, I wouldn't be surprised if the flash popped because, you know, I didn't know. I didn't care.
It's a look.
Yeah. It's whatever.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And then when I went back into the army for a long period of time, I worked a lot with radio there and writing and like a creative director and art directing and that sort of stuff. And then I didn't want to lose my like ability as a video photographer, like a video guy. I didn't want to like come out the other end and still be like, so where's the big like Panasonic shoulder camera and not be able to get work. So that's when I started doing DSLR photography. And that's when the YouTube channel started with a 600D Canon.
Wow.
And I did that until I got bored and started, because I was shooting a lot of RAW video in the early RAW video cameras, like the Red One and the early Black Magics and sort of stuff. And I really enjoyed like the grading process of it all to create a look. And then I realized that if I took still photos, I could go out and capture like 20 photos and grade them instead of like one clip of one. It would give me like a higher quantity of footage. And then I just realized quite quickly that now it's time to learn photography like properly. And since then, I haven't really cared about video. I mean, I review cameras that are excellent video cameras, but I sort of just brush over it these days compared to
apparently. Before. I love one of my favorite writers about cameras, a guy called Craig Mod, did that when he reviewed the Leica Q. He sort of wrote, when that first came out, he wrote about it being an incredible travel camera. Yeah. And his thing of that, like he ran through all the different things and lots of sample images and all the rest.
I think it shoot video or something like that.
Yeah, that's what he did. So at a certain point, he went, it also shoots video, and then just carried on. Like it just didn't matter to him, because I think sometimes it doesn't matter. It's not in the DNA.
And I used to do that. I used to do that the opposite way with video. Like if you look at I have a review of the Panasonic LX100 camera, which is a great compact stills camera. I don't mention stills at all in that video. It's just a camcorder in my mind. back then.
Yeah.
And today, yeah. I think when I talk about the LX100-2, I do the exact opposite. I don't think I mention video. No, I do, because Panasonic has, you can shoot stills with a mechanical shutter while recording video. And I think that is awesome, and everybody should have that. And I think if the TikTokers knew that, they might abandon Fuji, because then they can do their like point of view video and snap the photo, and the video just keeps rolling.
Yeah, yeah, no, that would be very cool. Like the phones do that. I didn't realize that camera could do that as well. I mean, it seems obvious.
And the Panasonic G7 as well. I don't know about the others, but those I know do that.
Yeah, that's very cool. That's very clever. Oh, wow. So when you started that move then to kind of like more getting into more still stuff, like how did you find that transition? Was it because on the one hand, you've got more things to grade and play with afterwards, which sounds like it's something that, you know, that's a little bit of this. It's like it's fun to tweak and fun to play with stuff.
Yeah.
But how did you find the learning curve? Because you've done that rare thing, I guess, of kind of dabbling in all the disciplines rather than just or limiting yourself to one. Like, what was that transition like?
What I really enjoyed about it was being a newbie, because I already had a bit of a platform then, because I had some following due to the videos, and it was kind of fun to be like a noob that made content and started talking, because it was totally fine if I today were to make a video where the images are somewhat subpar, even though that's subjective, but let's say they are. I would hear about it, but I mean, like back then it was totally fine, because I was like, I don't know at all what I'm doing here, but this camera is fun and this is why and I like it, and this it does not so good, but I don't care, and it was fine, and that was fun. It's fun to play and to just enjoy the process and create whatever you feel like. And as I get older and more, like today I'm confident as a photographer, but when I listen to like Joel Majewicz or someone, they always say the same thing. Like if you take a picture of something, let's say, maybe you enjoy selfies, and then people are like, learn proper photography, stop doing selfies, because, you know, people look down at the internet crowd taking selfies. But his mind and mine is like, if you enjoy that, take as many as you possibly can. And see where it goes. I mean, because you never know what's going to happen.
Well, and there's that exhibition, isn't there, at the moment in Stockholm, which focuses on like the history of the selfie and then encourages you to do it.
You take like a night class in oil painting, aquarelle, sculpture, whatever. Assignment number one, always the self-portrait. I mean, it's a legit art form, you know?
Yeah.
If it's an antique roadshow and they find a self-portrait by Zorn and it costs $2 million.
I mean, it doesn't happen as often as they'd like, though. That's lovely that you know about the antiques roadshow. That's amazing.
It's huge in Sweden.
Is it?
We have a Swedish version of it. And it's
It's
massive. It's been going on for like, I think, 31 years now. So we watched the Swedish Antique Roadshow, and then I watched clips. I don't see a full episode, but I watched the UK version in YouTube.
Yep. Wow. So I thought the Bake Off was the only thing we'd ever really successfully exported. Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? No, that's so cool.
And also, I think my wife watches some where they go around and look for summer houses or something like that.
Oh, yeah. The classic. I mean, I think the world loves house finding shows. My favorite thing, I don't know if this happens in the Swedish version of Antiques Roadshow, but when they do find out that the thing is worth something, when they say to the person, you know, and this is probably worth, and it's been sitting on a shelf and it's probably worth like £100,000, the people on ours always go, oh, well, I mean, I'd never sell it. And you know, you can see it in their face. They're like, but would I? Like, could I? Like, just because you've just been told that vase that, you know, was Auntie Maud's is suddenly worth more.
my wife's reaction is always, you should sell it. Because, like, you have a painting there for $1 million. I would sell that and then buy a nice painting for 10,000 to fill that.
Buy a print of the said painting. Like, go to find someone.
You've just exposed on TV that you're like this old couple in a little cottage somewhere with a Picasso. I mean, either I would sell the painting or I would buy a shotgun and a nice alarm.
Well, and that's they're not cheap. So, you know, maybe...
Shotguns, no. It depends.
No, no. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how much a shotgun costs. I couldn't possibly... A shotgun mic, maybe. Not an actual shotgun. Yeah.
I think yeah. they start around yeah. 500, maybe. Pounds, maybe. Around there.
Right.
30 euros.
There we go. See, we're providing a service here, educating people on how much guns cost around the world. So I guess from shooting potential intruders to shooting with lenses, it was the best segue I could come up with at the time. Your three lenses are quite interesting. So you chose like a 28, a 50 and a 75, which is a kind of from focal length perspective, is kind of a trinity we've seen before. Yeah. And it mirrors kind of what I carry. So I'm normally like either 28 or 35 and a 50. And then on the outside edge, you know, if I have all of them with me, I might have a 90 in there as well, which is kind of basically the same. So which one do you want to talk about first?
I think maybe we should start with the 50 because I'm an advocate of that being the first for everyone. Like when someone emails me and I do get that email a lot, like, hey, I'm thinking about buying my first camera. What should I get? And I say, buy the cool camera, the one that you like think looks awesome and feels nice that you can afford, and buy a 50 for it. Yeah, what about the kids and blah, 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 blah. Fine, sure. But add a 50 to the desk. like Tyler Stallman said in his absolute first video ever, like you simply can't leave the store without a 50.
Yes.
And it's good advice, I think.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, I'm a 35 person quite a lot of the time, but the 50 is on at the moment.
Yeah.
You know.
But even like if this was your first day with that, like, I mean, a 50 would be a pretty good start for you to know, like, is this too long or is this too short or is this perfect? And, I mean, you have to start somewhere. And I guess you could start with a 35. But if you start with a 50, you can do pretty decent portraits. You can do, I'm not going to call it wildlife, but you can take pictures of stuff a bit further away and crop. And you can do very decent landscapes, like extremely good landscapes. And especially on full frame.
Yeah, you can. I think the other thing with a 50 is sometimes when you're starting, getting close to people can be quite intimidating. I am a firm believer in that phrase of like, if your photos aren't good enough, you're not close enough.
Yeah.
And I think that's definitely real. But how close you have to be at 35 or 28 versus how close you are with 50. Yeah. I noticed that because before I got my M, my big camera love was the GR3. And I had shot that thing for years and adored it and adored the 28. Focal length on it, but everything I was shooting was either, it was all point and shooty type stuff, so it was landscapes and things around, it was a very sort of documentary style photos, or it was my family, like my wife and my kids, and so you can just get close to them, there's no kind of reticence or worry about getting close to them. So I think that's one of the reasons that I'm not a street photographer, is because I find that getting close, kind of, I don't want to get up in people's grill or in their business. And so I chickened out yesterday taking a photo that would have been fun. It was a police van in London with a bunch of police looking really bored, like leaning against the window. Some were asleep. They all looked just really bored, clearly waiting for something. And on the side of the van, it said, "We're hiring," like joint police.
I just thought,
yeah, I chickened out.
Officials are, they're used to it. You know? They're not going to be upset, I don't think.
But
also the 50 is cheap. I mean, every system has an affordable 50. You can tell that that's always what comes first. Like for the new mirrorless Panasonic or Nikon or whatever, they first came out with a couple of 50 1.8s that are affordable. Yeah. And that's like you with the 50 get a good lens at a price that a beginner asking the question could be comfortable paying, because if they're like, no, I really want to zoom, and there's like, yeah, but I can't recommend you a zoom for your modest budget, that's not gonna be pretty, like it's not gonna be excellent, it's not gonna be an f2.8 zoom, and then those images that draw you to photography that you've seen and that you're now going to try to replicate, it's going to be difficult for you. But if you get that cheap 50, set it to aperture priority f1.8, everything is going to be bokelicious, dreamy, creamy. Yeah. You do that for a while, and then you realize, like, okay, maybe there's more to photography in a shallow depth of field.
Yeah.
And you expect. I mean, the 50, when I bought that first 50, there was the Canon EF50, the old version that's not an STM. And it was, I think, 90 euros in a store in Italy. And I just went into like a hole in the wall type of like develop your film tourist place and just asked, expecting them not to have it, but they had it because that lens is everywhere. Like, oh, sure, we have that lens. Here it is. It's just so cheap. And today it's still like the same price, but they updated it. So it has an SDM motor, which makes it really good for video. So I still use that cheap 50 plastic Fantastic at work all the time for video interviews, because it's perfect for that. Like it's because shooting a video interview with 85, that's a bit long. And so 50 is perfect. And then the SDM motor is quiet, so I can just put it on like face tracking and just record and just trust that it's going to. And it cost 90 euros.
Yeah, amazing.
15 years ago, maybe I bought that one. And it still works.
Yeah, I was just talking to Vieren Pavic over at The Verge, and he was talking about the kind of the Canon 100 L mount. That's just, he's like, it's a cheap lens, but it's amazing.
Yeah.
Just does everything you need, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I have the for work at work, we have the 100 2.8 from Canon. Super cheap, super awesome. And I recently did a video. It was like part of my video about the Nikon D850 DSLR. I was just pointing to the fact that if you just let go of the notion that mirrorless is some sort of like magical camera, and just maybe see the benefit of an optical viewfinder, like you like a rangefinder, but like through the lens. I mean, there's something to get out of that. The value that you can find on the used market, if you be like, no, I'll settle with this awesome DSLR. So how much are there like early 1.8 lenses in EF and Nikon F mount? It's like, it's crazy what a value you get from that.
My first SLR was a Nikon D40, I think, and it, I had a 50mm 1.8 or something like that that I bought for that. And that whole setup now, I looked on MPB, that whole setup can be had now for less than £100 for body. And the thing is, like, yes, it's only 6 megapixels, but that's perfectly... Yeah, it's enough for a lot of things, you know, and it makes nice images.
And it's going to look awesome because, you know, low megapixel, large sensor size, like the saturation and everything is going to look so dreamy. You don't need to buy any presets for that camera. It's just...
No, CCD sensor as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and if you want to learn photography, talk about learning photography. It's like, maybe you want to learn, like get into film photography, but then you want to like practice. It's expensive with film today as well. I mean, and if you're into that, have that DSLR on the side so you can like shoot thousands of images practicing composite, and it's going to end stuck at maybe ISO 100 and like learn to use that.
Yeah, use
and
it.
And that was like good because, because I started with a Leica M8 and I have that in maybe maximum ISO 320 or something and got by. So then when I have the opportunity to have ISO 50,000 or something, I mean I get more out of it because I could do the job with 160 or 320.
I've actually had to relearn that a little bit recently with the M, because I've got an M11 and I was still shooting it like it was the D40, right? So I would never go higher than 1600 and I was always stuck at very slow shutter speeds. And it was, and then you're adding on top of that manual focus, and like there was a learning curve with my M of like starting with the M10 and through. And I just recently, like, talking right back to the beginning of the conversation, talking about auto is good, right? I finally allowed myself to just stick it on ISO auto and just drive it the way I want to drive it, and just let it worry about that, because more often than not, I'm not even aware of whether it's a, you know, 1600 or 3200 or whatever. No. Like, it doesn't, as long as you expose it correctly, it doesn't matter. You know, you just don't see it anymore.
No. In theory, they should all look the same if they get the light they need, like if the light meter says it's good, then it's good.
You get away with murder these days.
And then, I recently tried the Leica Q2 monochrome, and I've never looked really at the ISO, but I think it's like in the millions. It feels like
yes, it's insane.
It's a night vision camera. No, I like The Cure. And I've heard that it's been mentioned a lot here on the, in every episode. Everyone asks you. Maybe I'm not as like in much in love as some of the others I've heard, but I really, really, really like it. I would love to have one, just to have one. But I have, you have a one camera rule. I have a two camera rule, so it doesn't really fit in there. But definitely, like the next lens we'll talk about is the 28, and I love the 28, so it's perfect. And I enjoy Leicas, and I never shot the Q2, but now when I've tried the Q2 monochrome, I realized that the Q2 must be some powerhouse with the autofocus, and because it's so refined, it's like every maybe thing that bothered me a little bit with the Q is gone in the Q2. Everything from the power button being more precise and everything.
I tried the Q2 when I was in Wetzlar last year. I went to the museum and I stayed, and it was a whole thing. I was there for a conference, and I stayed an extra day so that I could go down to Wetzlar and wander around, and they let me try a Q2 monochrome. And it was really nice to handle, but I find those the lower aperture lenses are so much longer that I just sort of don't want that length. Like the body size is perfect, but I'd be a bit like the Sony, the RX1 and 1R. Yeah, like I'd go for a stumpier lens to be my travel.
With a slower aperture, it's worth the trade-off.
I think it's worth the trade-off for one stop, especially when you start to factor in the performance of the sensor.
Yeah, ISO a million, then you can have usually me and my friends that shoot film, we always also talk about ISO from the other's perspective, that we want a low ISO, you know, like a low base ISO.
Yeah. Like down to 64 or something.
Yeah, we're talking about 25.
Oh, wow. Okay. What's the rationale for wanting to go that low?
Shoot wide open in bright sunlight, or a long exposure without an ND filter.
Yeah.
Now we're kidding, of course, but I mean, my friend that I was talking about, he only shoots large format Polaroids on expired film of dead trees. I mean, he's kind of a speciality type guy.
That's very specific.
So he's like, give me 25 and I'm good, because I guess those expired films from like the 70s that he used, he probably rates them at like ISO 12 or something to get an exposure.
Yeah, it's crazy to think old film. I've got a couple of bags of old film that, like, some of them go back to the 90s or late 80s that were given to me by a friend. And speaking to film people who are like, oh, you can totally still shoot that. You
A stop like, per decade or something.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So you just keep going down and down and down. And I guess if, you know, trees aren't moving, and they're not going anywhere. Yeah.
And who cares? I mean, I have a video somewhere where I bought Polachrome. Have you seen that?
Yes.
Remember that? Yeah. And I found with three unopened packs of film, and I think two gave me actual images. I had to be quite rough with them, scrubbing off they have sort of a remjet type of cover on them.
Yeah.
So those images, and I posted the image, and people were like, wow, these images are really bad. And I'm like, what? I love them. They're so scratched up and weird, and the color shifts. And I think I rated it at ISO 20 or something like that in an EOS 3. I mean, like a quite modern film camera.
Oh wow! It was just normal 35mm, if my memory serves.
Yeah, the roll was.
Did you develop it?
Yeah, I can send you the video, because it's really. I mean, the device is like, when you watch the video, you're going to be sad because it's not made anymore. It's going to make you sad that you missed this. But it's basically a regular roll of film, and then it's every film comes with a little cube with a developing fluid. So then you take you shoot it like normal, then you put it in this little processor that comes with it. You put the film in, and then that little cube, and then you like spool it over, like zip, and then it's developed and done. Like instant developing. So awesome. It's like pack film. Like, it's over now. You can buy some on eBay for $1,000 a pack. But I mean, there was a time when.
Yeah.
And that same guy, the large format guy, he gave me a pack film camera once, and two or three packs of film. And he just said, like, this is going away now because they've stopped the production. It's pretty soon it's going to be out in every store because it's so popular. And you're going to hate yourself if you missed it, if you never shot it. So like, here's three packs of film. Go out and shoot.
Oh, wow. That's cool. I had my first experience with Peel Apart film at the weekend. I saw Ben Fratinali, who does In an Instant. I was in New York. And so I went up to see him and his wife and their lovely dog. And yeah, they did an 8x10 of me in duochrome. Oh, yeah. And then they also did some peel apart and we shot a load of Polaroids. And it was so good. I also really want lights now and a background so I can do some, because that's something I've never dabbled with before.
Yeah.
But he had a room, he's got a studio space there. And so the room I'm in right now is about a third the size you'd probably want to be able to space things out properly and to be able to do this. So I need to find a space, but it would be incredible to do that. That would be awesome.
Yeah, it would be so fun. There's some like space is what's hindering me from like having a studio set up and learning more about that. And having a dark room would be awesome. Yeah. And I could probably make some sort of makeshift because I develop film at home a lot, but then scanning it, I would like to do like the final step at home as well.
Yeah.
But
all right, so you send it away to be scanned, do you?
No, I scanned it myself.
Oh, you scanned it, right.
But I would like to make wet prints, basically.
Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah.
I'm looking for like, back in the day, it wasn't that hard to find in Sweden photo clubs because like you can get government support for anything, like a soccer team or if you want to have something. And then if you gather 10 people and you have like a photo club and they're still around, then they get like grants and that's the way they could keep their darkrooms for a long period of time. But where I live, there aren't any, but like in Stockholm, there still are and stuff. They are super cheap to join. It's like 200, I mean like 20 euros a month and then you're in and then you can, and you get to buy discounted chemicals and everything.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah. There's not really a culture of camera clubs left in the UK either. No. Like, that series Detectorists, I don't know if you've ever seen it, has like a thing about like the Detectorists Club. And so like that's very much how clubs like that do remain. But I think increasingly, unfortunately, the members are probably of a generation.
Yeah.
It might not be very attractive to like new people to come in and join, you know, to kind of be a part of it if there's like, it feels kind of stale, a little bit fusty maybe. But yeah, well, that's a really cool thing. I'm glad that they support and they're supporting the arts. Because our government's always amazing at supporting the arts.
No. It would be cool to do stuff like that. But time and everything.
Time and space. Well, talking about time and space, space then, if 50 was your first, space that is captured by a 28. Hey, there we go, segue. So which was you've got a 28. Is there a 28 that you love in particular? Or is it just, it's the framing?
No, I think it's the framing. Like if I had to pick one, maybe I would pick the Ricoh GR because that's the 28 that I've used the most then. And it's, you know, it's obviously one of my favorite cameras for basically all the reasons there can be. I bought the 50 first and then I needed something wider and basically thought the 35 was maybe a bit too close. Like if it's going to be wider, let it be really wider then. And it was a 28 Voigtlander, but then I got stuck with that. And it was when the Q came out, I watched a lot of videos and stuff about that. Not like maybe wanting the camera, but then they always talked a lot about the 28, about getting closer and everything. And I started like, yeah, that's true. Maybe I should try and start to get closer to people. And then when I got the Fuji X70 before the GR, but like the same era, small, inconspicuous, then I started getting really close to people. And quite quickly, I just realized that most people don't really care. You can go pretty darn close. And that thing that I get it, like it's intimidating when you say that you maybe don't want to get up in their business and anything. Mm. But I'm telling you, if you start doing it a little bit, you're going to notice that very few care.
Yeah.
Like at all.
Yeah. They just let it happen.
Yeah, they know. And my like philosophy a bit on the street, because there's like two camps, I guess, the ones that think that you should wear like olive green clothes and try to blend in with a stealthy camera or something.
Oh,
and then the opposite, which is me. I'm very obvious because people are like, how can you take people, don't these people get like, don't they notice that you take pictures of them? And it's like, yeah, they notice because I'm very obvious with it. And I'm maybe often standing. So they know, like, either I, okay, if I like in their mind, they will be like, if I walk past this sign here now, that guy is going to take a picture of me. And I mean, I give them all the opportunity in the world right. to stop, to pick another route, to say stop, whatever. And obviously yeah. they is like, whatever. And then they just walk through and you get the picture.
Oh, nice. I need to practice that bravery. I lack that bravery.
No, and it's fun. Usually, often you start talking to them and because they're maybe they want the picture. Usually it's like, yeah, here's my Instagram. Like, you're going to see yeah. it there. Like,
yeah, that's fun. No, that's really, really cool. Yeah, I found the 28 was perfect. I love the Elmerit. My 28 go-to, which I think is really underrated. Yeah, I really love that lens.
And the Sumarit as well.
Yes. Yeah, I've not tried the Sumarit, but the ones I've seen online.
Yeah, great value. No, but yeah. I had the Elmerit for many of my M's, and it's awesome, basically.
Yeah. So good. And small, right? Like, keeps that package really, really tight. When I was in Cologne last year at Gamescom, that was a really good lens all week. I just kept it on the front because I was going around a show, you're at a trade show, you've never got any room. It's always packed. There's always loads of people around. And so just being able to get really, really close to like things that you see was really good.
And I can say one of the very like why I started using the 28 a lot was that in the beginning I was using zone focus maybe exclusively for a long time. That's what I did, and that's why I switched from the X70 to the GR because of the snap focus. But I don't really use the snap on it. I set the manual focus and save it to a preset so I can have my own zones. Okay. And then you in the GR you can label them. So when I switch from custom 1, 2, 3, then on the display it says 2 to 8 meters, 8 to 30, like, so I know. And a 28 is much, much easier to zone focus than a 35.
Mm.
So why did the lens easier, you know? Because on a 28, you can focus maybe 5 meters out, and then basically everything you see is in focus. If you're at f5.6, and then you ride the ISO, and you set the shutter speed of 500, so now no one's walking faster than shutter 500 here in the street that I'm entering, and the ISO is fine, and then 5.6 is enough, and 5 meters, then I know anything I see from now until 5 blocks away, I can take a picture basically. Of, just frame it, and don't care about the rest.
Yeah,
that was a great start for me to do that in the beginning, to just focus on composition and.
Nice.
And then you can still say, like, do you shoot in full auto? Then you said, no, I shoot in full manual.
Which, of course, is worth all the brownie points.
But it's more auto than auto. Full auto with exposure composition is more like fiddly than what I did. What I did was just set and forget.
Yes. But that requires a kind of, as you say, like a practice and a learning of the kind of the principles of this. Because I think it's taken me, I mean, I've had an M for 2 years. And it's only really now that I fully comprehend, I think, what, you know, this is year two. So.
Yeah, I started by looking at the scale on the lens itself, because you can see the distances there. And then realizing that it's usually further than that. The lens is with in a safe margin. And view of what's in focus could be a little bit outside that maybe. And with 28, you're so close. By focusing quite close, you can hit par focal when everything is in focus, and you can be safe with that. But that's the Sigma DP1. People say it's difficult to shoot because it's only ISO 100. But the thing with that is, if you set, because it has a physical focus wheel with meters, so you set it to I think it's 3 meters. And then you can put it on shutter speed 500, ISO 100, and the ISO's maximum is f4. So the maximum it can get wide open will still give you a deep zone. So you can zone focus in shutter speed priority with that camera.
Yeah.
And you're good to go. So it's super easy to use.
Nice and quick, really fast. Because I've noticed from a lot of your compositions, this is starting to make a lot more sense now. There's a point at which this happens. during most conversations. But some of your images are so quick. They look like, you know, like that, the one of the ones you've shared recently of your dog running towards you with an amazing, like tremendous, great compositions. But I guess you're going into those scenarios not having to worry about anything but composition, because you're kind of all set and ready to go.
Yeah, I'm running, taking that picture. So I'm, I'm holding the camera down, and I set the dog down, like sit there, and then I walk away a couple 5 meters, and then I hold the camera down, looks, and then I start running. And then she starts chasing me, and then I start hammering the shutter. And I know that if she is within 2 to 20 meters from me, she will be in focus enough to make an image.
It's such a lovely capture of, you know, the one you chose. I really, really love how dynamic it is, and how, but there's also, it's like, I love how easy you make it. It's images like that make it look, and then knowing that it definitely isn't easy. It's really satisfying to see someone work in that way. What do you do with all those pictures? And so, because you're, when you're reviewing cameras, you've tested cameras, like you cycle them in and out. We've talked a little bit on Instagram about how you kind of archive, but like, do you have like things that you're doing with them, or is this just part of the obsession, you're sort of storing them to look at?
I do stuff. I mean, the YouTube, the camera reviews are an excuse for me to showcase images on YouTube, basically. That's like half of it. I enjoy cameras. I like geeking them out and talking about it and having questions, blah, blah, blah. But it's also, I usually have a rule of having 25 images that I am satisfied with in each five reasons video, five for each reason. So that's one thing I do with them. I showcase them and use YouTube disguised as camera reviews. Because if I made a video like, look at my 25 pictures that I'm proud of, no one would look at it. And we used to do that all the time in the video DSLR boom days. People, like, we made these little short montages with music that we thought looked good, and then we labeled them lens test. It was just made up. So people made like short films with scripts and lights and actors and everything, and it was a lens test. Get views. So I do that, and then I have two walls with frames in my house with printed images, and we switch them out every time, every now and then. And it's, some images are family, of course, and from our trips, and some are like my street shots of some kid that no one knows. And it's still fun. And we make photo books every year, me and my wife. We have an Instax printer and a couple of albums with Instax. Every year, not every year, but my wife sometimes, and I think it's pretty cool, it's a good tip for what people can do. She goes to her Instagram, and then there are those services that like prints all your Instagrams from that year on like almost Polaroid replicas. They look like Polaroid prints. And then she just takes them all and puts them in a candy bowl, and we have them like on the coffee table. So people that come and sit down for a while, they can like grab a fistful and just flip through. Like, you don't have to like make a book and label and stuff. You can just have it like that. So like a nice, like a candy bowl, but it's just photos. And you just like take them up, you pick them up by the fist and be like, oh, when they're all out of order and then out of context. And
it's awesome. That's really nice. Yeah, I'm with you on the printers as well. We have... I have a high print. The Polaroid high print is really quite fun because they're sticky. So when I travel for work, if people follow me on Instagram, they'll have seen little scrapbook. Like, I have little field note sized books that I stick them in and scribble next to as I'm going, along with like sticking in receipts, or like, you know, when I go to a cool game studio or whatever, I keep the badge if they let me keep it, because it's, they usually turn a funny color after a few hours, so you can't use them again. So I stick those in my notebook so I can be like, that was the time I went to see, you know, Bethesda Game Studios or whatever. It's really cool. So stuff like that. But I've got the Instax Square printer. That's really great for this sort of thing. But I do love the idea of a bowl. And we don't have any babies or pets that would eat them. The kids are old enough now that they would.
Yeah, and I probably wouldn't do with the Instax, because we don't know yet how sensitive they are to environment and everything. But with those services where like we print your Instagram feed for, I mean, they cost nothing.
Yeah.
They're super cheap. So we do that. And I print some scenes and stuff. And then, of course, I do a lot of photography work. And that's in magazines. And wherever.
Different, whole different world. You were posting today actually about being in a magazine and the yeah, stuff I saw that today. Weird,
that was the weirdest thing because I noticed that one of my a bit older videos were having a spike on YouTube. I saw like in a couple of thousand people looked at this today, and I'm like, usually that means that someone wrote something somewhere about it. So I Googled, I couldn't find. So then I Googled my name, which is sort of weird, but I did. And looks, have anybody mentioned me in the last like week? And there was this a magazine and a PDF of a nice glossy magazine about the Cannes Film Festival or something. And I was like, is my name really in here, or is there just like, you know, Matthias Andersson and Michelle Buhling, and that's why it. And then I found it, and no, it was talking about me, and there was this Oscar-nominated photographer that just talked about his, like we're doing now, like how did it all start? And he was like, yeah, and then I went to YouTube and I found this guy, Matthias Buhling, and he mentioned it, like, and he said just to go out and shoot, so I did.
He was like, right. That's what you should do. Yeah, definitely.
I was like, yeah, that's pretty good advice.
Where is that guy now? I hope he's doing okay.
Exactly.
That's so cool. I also liked the bit that you cut out and shared on about the top guys get on their helicopters to the Antarctic or whatever and take their incredible. And I think there is a real danger. It was why I started doing these. Right, is that there's a real danger that every conversation about photography assumes that you have to, spend tens of thousands of dollars on cameras. It's got to be your only job.
No, and I mean, like, the location thing is I want to be a landscape photographer, but I can't afford to travel. It's like, then don't.
Yeah, yeah.
Take pictures at home, because I've talked about that in some things I wished I knew 5 years ago or something, because. Like where we used to live, like the lake there is really small, and I have like 1,000 pictures from there. They're all kind of different, and I learned a lot. And from where we moved it to where we left is totally different. So I'm like, and a lot of people that travel a lot also maybe tend to travel to different places and take the same picture. They go to this town and find a street where the light comes from the side, so they get the silhouette of the guy with the umbrella. And then they go to the next town and do the same thing instead of staying in that time and shoot the same street corner when it's cloudy or something. So if I could, if you're out there wanting to start photography and then you say, but I would like to do street photography, but my town is so boring or something, it's like, it's not. You're just going to have to find something interesting about it. Like when I go to work assignments, it's always like, oh, can you shoot a video about this thing? And I'm like, oh my God, it's the most boring thing in the world. But that's not my job. My job is to get it done. So then I get it done. And after a while, you learn to find what's interesting.
Well, on that subject, when you're finding something that a 75 mil lens is your kind of final choice.
No, I think it's 70. I don't know.
Oh, it's 70. Sorry.
I think it's 70. We're basically talking about a portrait lens, because that was my next step was going from an amateur. I'm still an amateur, I think, but going from only taking pictures for my own benefit to incorporating it to work. Because nowadays it's on my resume, and a big part of my job is to take photos. And then I had to start taking portraits, because that's, if you're in marketing and PR, you will take a lot of portraits, and they're going to be of a guy in a suit. And you can't have a studio, so you're going to have to learn to find nice backgrounds and bounce lights and whatever.
Yeah, shoot with available light. And how do you find dealing with people who aren't used to being photographed very often? Because that, for me, seems like a challenge.
Yeah, it is. But you're just going to have to... I think it comes down a lot to me. I'm pretty talkative, and I mean, you build a rapport with the person. I think that goes a long way, and maybe, you know, like breaking the ice and just acknowledging, I think, a lot that they're nervous. Like, I understand. Like, I can see that you're nervous, and I understand. I would be too. No one likes to be in front of a camera, and believe me, you're not more nervous than anybody else, so cut yourself some slack. Try to get them to ease off,
and try and enjoy it.
And then you can also have some tricks, you know, like basics, because they're usually, how should I stand, how should I have my hands, and then you can have small just maybe lean over to your toes a little bit, or maybe have maybe move your hands outside of frame.
Yeah. Yeah, I was listening to Marc Maron this morning, and he was talking about making his TV show, which I think he did like 4 or 5 seasons of. And he said he spent the first 2 seasons not knowing what to do with his hands. And he's like, yeah, you can see it. Like, he can see it now in the thing. He's just, but it's, it, I always struggle to give advice for stuff like that, because I spend all of my time behind a camera, yeah, not in front of it. And I don't tend to pose people for stuff. I tend to like, I'll flatter myself as like documentary style photography, mm-hmm, right? Of like, this is what was happening. It was family. It was little people running around. It was a dog. It was a bird in the garden, or, you know, whatever it is. So you kind of tend not to have to do that. So yeah, I suppose you do need an armory of tips and tricks, like depending
on... Just a couple of ones.
Yeah.
And like, I would say, stand like you're in the line for the ATM or something.
Yeah.
So like, it's basically not posing, just standing, yeah, there. Like,
you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's why I think it's been an important tool in my arsenal. But I wrote down 70mm just to be on that. If something grabs your attention and you think it's interesting or fun, you should just go with it. And that's because my latest lens acquisition is the 70 that's on my DJI Air 3 drone.
Right, yes.
And that's the latest lens I bought, because I had the DJI Pro, Mini Pro. That's the drone I bought. And it has a 24mm lens.
Yeah.
And I've enjoyed it tremendously. It's been fun. I haven't had it only for a couple of weeks. And then I was like, oh man, I wish I had longer focal length. And then I was like, should I spend the money on another drone? Like, is this just for play? I mean, like, is this justifiable? And then I thought, like, come on, you're a photographer, for crying out loud. Of course, you need 2 lenses at least on your like flying cameras.
Yes.
So I went for it. So now I have 2 drones.
So. Oh, I'm so jealous. I'm not allowed a drone. We've agreed as a family that we don't want a drone. And I support that message.
I've said that for years. I thought it was stupid. No, and it's stupid, but for me, stupid to have one.
Yeah, like,
that's just a toy. You're just gonna play with it. Mm-hmm, you're just gonna crash it, and the image is crap. That was back in 2011 when people started like DIY mounting GoPros to the like Phantom 1 and the Apple Parrot or whatever they were called. And I was like, no, that's not for me. If I need a drone shot, I'll hire a professional, like for work, and for my private, I don't care. Because I thought it was quite quickly overused with drone shots in video. And then for stills, I was like, nope, the image is still crap. No. And I just waited and waited, and the years go. And I looked in every now and then, how's it going in the drone business? Like, nope, still crap. Good. I don't need to buy one. And then my dad is 71 and not really into photography. He's into wildlife. So he has a camera and a long lens and takes pictures of birds and foxes and stuff. He came with a drone, with a DJI Mini Pro, no, DJI Mini 3 to my house. Like, I bought this drone so I can find the mushrooms and berries without walking so far in the woods. And I was like, okay. And then he said, let's take it out. So we took it out and I flew a little bit outside here. I did a Passover on my kid on her like tricycle. And I took like 1 photo of a lake over here. And it was like, okay, let's go order a drone.
Yeah, that's how they get you. Yeah. It's, imagine having multiple conversations a week with people talking about cool gear. Like, it's, you know, it's going to be expensive. I know that much. Did you see the drone that someone built? I think it was the end of last year, where they mounted a Polaroid.
Oh, yeah. So that was awesome. I've already started thinking, like, what else can I mount to a drone?
Yeah, you'd have to, I guess you have to get a heavier duty drone. Like, the ones that come with, like, the minis and stuff are so small, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're sort of, weight limit,
and also like there's a lot of restrictions, so and that's the worst part, because if I could I probably would now just sell the smaller drone to just have one. The problem is the small one, I can fly over people and it's small and quiet and everything. The large one, I'm not allowed to fly over people. I needed to take like an exam to get it.
Which is probably good, given that sometimes they fall out of the sky.
It is so good that they have some sort of restrictions on this, because the big one, it's heavy and it goes pretty quickly, and you can fly you can easily fly long past where you can't see it anymore.
That would scare me a little bit. like not being able to see it anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, I've tried it. It's not really, I'm only allowed to fly as long as I can see. That's like the law. Unless I like apply a permit, like, hello, I would like to fly further than I can see this weekend. And they can like shut off the airspace and blah, blah, blah. But over the lake, I've been like confident to like before the boat season, I did a couple of passes out where like, okay, I can't see it now. Maybe I go a little bit further and pretty quickly like, nope, return to home. And I press like the emergency return to home button.
Right.
It's scary. You never know what's going to happen. Like two other people, the drone, I mean, that's just my loss. But
yes,
if you were to crash on someone else, then that wouldn't feel very good.
No, and not only that, to have video evidence live of the damage you're doing would feel it's bad enough. Like when I've dropped my motorbike or something like that and scratched it, well, that's just your fault, right? Like, that just makes you sad because you've scratched the paintwork on your car or your bike or whatever. But yeah, if in the process you clobber someone in the back of the head, I think that would feel pretty terrible.
But I definitely abuse the drone like I do my regular cameras. Like I bought it to use it, so I went to a shut down old mine lately. I think it's called limestone, the white stone limestone.
Yeah.
Quarry, maybe that's the correct word, a quarry. Mm-hmm. And then they have like this hill with a bunch of trees and you can peek through and you can see like the big quarry. And I was like, this is perfect. I sent the drone like between the trees and down there and started flying around this closed off quarry and everything and turning. Yeah. It was quite sketchy. I could definitely have lost it there. And then there was some guy camping up there and he's like, aren't you like, what if it crashes down there? Like, and I was like, yeah, but you know, I bought it to use it.
Yeah.
Why is it?
Yeah.
A long time ago, I saw a guy post on this with like 2012 when time lapse was a huge thing. Everybody was doing time lapses. And he said like on a forum, like, hello, The best thing in the world that brings me joy is to make time lapses. But now I read that my camera is only rated for like 200,000 acquisitions before the shutter will break. And I'm just a kid, so I can't afford to buy a new camera. What should I do? Like, and we started replying, like, you should make time lapses. A lot of them. And then some people are like, but yeah, but then his camera, I'm like, yeah, but didn't you hear? I love to make time lapses, then make them till the camera breaks and have a couple of them that you love, or have it on the shelf and have nothing but a depreciating camera.
Exactly.
And no joy. Ever since, you know, got married and have a kid and a mortgage and everything. And like the camera budget is my own budget. I mean, it doesn't really affect, but it still is hard for me to not see it as the economy as a whole.
Yes.
And then it's like, I can't have a $2,000 camera sitting on a shelf and not use it. If it stays there for like perfect occasions and I still bring another one, then it has to go. And sometimes I know, like when I sold my like M6 or something, this is going up and up and up in value. Like I could make money, but I was like, no, I better just stick to my like regiment, because otherwise I'm gonna have 1,000 different. Oh, I didn't sell that one because it might go up in value, and I didn't sell that one because and then I invent all of these but I have, like you, that there are some cameras that are like exceptions, because I know you can keep Instax cameras instant cameras, and I have as well. I have a couple of Polaroids, and then I have a couple of old, like really old film rangefinder, fixed lens rangefinders that aren't really worth anything. Like if I sold them, I would get like $5. And then it's like,
that may as well stay for the sentimental value, you know?
Yeah. And they're pretty. Like my wife thinks that they look cool, like in the shelf or something.
Yes.
Like old silver, shiny, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. What? It's like a child's drawing of a camera, you know, and those sorts of cameras.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I have an i1 that is now relegated to that exact scenario because the battery is just
the black one.
Yeah. Just the battery in it was never very good. And now if I charge it, and so I don't know how yours is doing, but mine, when I charge it, it will take one photo but not fully eject the picture. It doesn't have enough power anymore. So the battery's had it. And so really it's decorative now, which is a shame. It's lovely, but I have an i2, which is amazing.
Yeah. That's why the SX70 is such a marvel.
Yeah.
It's like no one is ever going to be able to make it again.
No. Not to that quality, not to that standard. Yeah. I mean, in current money, what was it? It would have been over $2,000 if it was in today's money.
And if you buy one, I have a broken one as well as a fully working one, but I know I know Mint can fix the brokenness of it for, I think, 100 euros because a friend sent in one with the exact same issue. So if you find one that working, you put in film, it takes the picture, but it never spits it out, that's 100 euros for you to fix that. So you can maybe find it in a flea market and be like, this is, I give you 5 for it, you know?
Yeah.
And then you know, it's okay, 105. And that's a bargain for a serviced SX7. Yes.
Yeah. I have a 680, which now that I have the TDI2, so cool. Such a cool thing with, like, when you tell people that it uses sound to focus, it blows their mind. And I love that the I2 uses LiDAR, because that feels like the natural progression somehow. Right. It's sort of similar but different.
The I2 is high on my list. It's just outside of the spontaneous purchase. Price,
but it's definitely.
And the one I told you about when I shot that Polar Chrome roll that I found, the EOS 3, I think it's called. That old film camera has eye focus in the sense that you can look at the focus point that you want it to use, and it works. And it's from like the 90s. I mean, if they put that in now, in like the new whatever Sony blah blah has this new eye thing, everybody would be like, oh my god, it's the best thing ever.
Yeah, you can use a little joystick. No, I think it's funny how we've kind of taken features away routinely in technology and then given it back to you later, and you're glad.
Yeah,
you know, in a funny way, happens all the time.
The switching to mirrorless thing, the manufacturers pushing it pretty hard, and it's like, I wonder if they're like doing us a favor or if they want to sell us new lenses where they have a proper markup compared to the bodies, which they probably almost break even on, like, if that.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like Leica are doing okay.
They and Canon, they went even through like the 2008 crisis and everything. I think they were profitable, both companies.
Yeah.
No, and we like it's the same, like Rolex and them were also profitable because maybe the majority of the clientele isn't that sensitive to economic trends.
it's a heart purchase. I remember through the pandemic and the origin of this thing, you know, that was a dream about Jason Momoa showing me his lens collection. But I remember seeing him once, it was on a live stream during the pandemic and everyone was at home and nobody was going anywhere. And he was doing something about his camera collection, and I think just casually in the background was a Leica that had recently sold for like $3 million at auction, and it's just on his shelf in the background. He just wanted it. It's just like, there it is. It's part of my collection. So yeah, you're right. Like, some to varying degrees, some of their customers are not.
Yeah, and also like it's a myth, I think, a bit like, oh, you have to be rich to use a Leica. And I mean, no, you just have to prioritize differently, maybe, because an M8 is still, you can still find them for like 1,000 euros. It's not super easy, but they pop up every now and then, especially like when the Leica M12 is released around there, all the others like drop in the used markets. And then you can maybe pick one up. And that's pretty, I remember recently I got a comment from someone that was like, when I said something like that, I did that video, like, which Leica is best for a beginner? And I think for a beginner. And then it was the M8. And then he was like, no, but you still have to be super rich. I could never afford that, blah, blah, blah. So I clicked this avatar there on YouTube and looked at his channel. And him and his girlfriend had a travel channel going all around the world. And I'm like, dude, it's less than one of these plane tickets. You could definitely afford one. You just choose other stuff, like your camera budget is really small. I get it, but the money you could, if you wanted to, if you gave up the other stuff,
for a short while. If you're traveling, exactly. I was just going to say, if you're traveling that much, then maybe not giving up more than one trip. I mean, hopefully, it's self-sustaining as well.
Go someplace cheaper. Go to where you buy the camera. Take pictures there. Yeah. And
it's like you were saying at the beginning. It's like the landscapes. Just photograph a landscape near you. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good enough. Try different.
A staycation video with your new camera.
Yeah, and if you buy a flying camera, you get another. Yeah. It's really you work in video games. Like I'm the video game generation. You know, remember the first 3D game you played?
Yeah.
Like it's not like linear anymore. You're like, oh, I can like go in all of these. Imagine your photography is like you have sideways up and you can crouch down and maybe raise it up. Imagine if you could go diagonally that way, 200 meters.
Yeah.
And put the camera over there and get that angle.
Oh, it'd be so good.
I wonder what this castle looked from the other side. Oh, wait, I just fly over and look.
Yeah.
It's
be so cool. Be so and cool.
And if you're into video games, you love like driving them. I don't know if you've steered one, because it was the first time when my dad's. And it was just that. That was also the epiphany. Oh, it's not just about the photography. I mean, it's actually fun, just like, whoa, like steering and making cool turns and everything.
Yeah, this is racing, is how.
Yeah, yeah, it's like playing pro am on the NES, but like in the air.
Yeah,
and I remember one of the absolute first drone videos I saw was about with a channel called the Drew Network. It's canceled now. This is 10 years ago, and he tried like the Phantom 1 or 2, and that back then it was like, can I do it? Will I crash? This is hard. And he was like, okay, if you played any sort of video game in your life, like Sega Rally or whatever, like you are going to, it's going to be fine. So unless you're a complete moron, I say you could buy. And I thought that was the funniest thing ever. Like, unless you're a complete moron, you should be fine. So, and I think he also said, like, so if you're a moron, you shouldn't buy this.
Maybe that's where I'm going wrong. I just don't call people morons enough, and it doesn't make them respect my authority. You know, that's what we're doing. That's where I'm going wrong with it.
That was awesome.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Time has flown.
I hope it was worth your while.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. It's definitely worth my while to see someone.
Because I'm gonna hate it myself. Because if there's something I learn in radio, like hearing yourself and hearing yourself reasoning and talking, it's like the worst thing ever. Like, do I really sound like that? Like, you know.
Yeah. I don't disagree. I think because listening back to these and hearing myself speak, I have a little kind of post-it on my desk. I'll show you this. It says yeah, yep, and yeah, no. To remind me not to say those things as much as I have clearly been saying them.
Yeah, and I do too. And also, I think because we can see each other and it's the same in radio, like I'm nodding, except like the listener can't hear my nod or me like doing like this or something. I don't know. Like,
I think it's a kind of, I've tried to come to this as I do more of them and hopefully get better at them. I'm trying to leave space for people to answer and trying to kind of let them fill the gap a little bit, because I feel it's a difficult thing, because I feel like someone listening to this won't necessarily know me. They've probably not turned up to listen to me. They've probably come because they've heard of you or seen your videos, and they're interested in something that isn't made by you but is, you know, has your perspective.
So. And also, like, being quiet, that's one other thing when I do, like when I teach interviewing, because I do that sometimes, I have at least in the past, some journalists and working in PR. And the one example they used in school to show how you should, as an interviewer, really do that, give long pauses, be quiet, and the other person will be like compelled to tell more if you're getting like a short answer. Mm. And the example is from when the ship Estonia sunk in the Baltic Sea. It's 20 years ago now, and like 500 people or something died, 600. And then the Swedish radio did an interview with telephone interview with one of the survivors just a few days after. And it's like, how was it? And it's like, oh, it was so scary. I was cold and I got in the lifeboat. And then he was just quiet. He didn't ask any more questions. It was like a long pause, like uncomfortably long pause. And then she just started like, I remember. And then she just started. And then she gave this longest, like, dramatic, like really told the story like in detail and with feelings, and it was like the best ever, like description of what happened, and just by him letting her take her time and like get it out there.
Well, I feel we've done that with 50, 28 and 70. You see, we've just let it all out there. I feel like this is the definitive 50, 28, 70 discussion. No one can match this.
And I feel like, have you even talked about that? I think we went on tangents.
That's the secret, right? Just just like you say, gear doesn't matter, right? Yeah, that's what this is all about. It's actually just conversation. It's really nice. I'm getting messages from listeners now where they're saying that they're just enjoying the kind of like the low key one-on-one conversation.
Yeah, I've been listening to the earlier episodes on my way to work in the car.
Oh, cool.
And it's been, and I think that's what I like about it. It's been just like, I mean, like this, like if I meet someone when I work in sports arenas, usually, you know, you stand around between the classes or whatever, if it's a question, and then we just start shooting the breeze. That conversation is pretty interesting. Like,
yeah.
Because it's usually the same. It starts with like, oh, Canon. Oh, yeah, Nikon. And then quite quickly, we don't care at all because no one really cares. We just talk about, you know, food in different arenas. Or
yeah. Yeah. You find the stuff to talk about for sure. No, that's nice. I had that yesterday. I saw, I was in London, bumped into Dan Milner briefly, and he was doing a photo book thing with some people who were like wanting some help sequencing and stuff. And yeah, one of the guys there has a couple of Leicas, but is getting rid of one so that he can have another body. Cause he's like, it's too expensive to have two of these.
Yeah.
And Dan has thrown a grenade into his, he was going to go Fuji. He was all ready. And then Dan is loving his ZF at the moment, the Nikon. And it's thrown a bomb into this guy's plan. Now he has to, because he was already, he was like, it's great. My girlfriend loves Fuji. I've used them. I know what I'm doing. And then Dan's like,
awesome justification. My girlfriend.
Yeah. He's like, then we can both feed each other's gear. Exactly. We can both feed each other's gear habit. It's this like self-fulfilling thing, you know?
I used to say that when people are like, I want to buy that camera, but I can't for my wife or something. I'm like, buy it for her as a Christmas present and hope that she gets bored of it and just leaves it up and you borrow it.
Yes. Borrow it. Yeah. Yes. I think that went wrong for Hugh Brownstone recently where he
bought the CEO ended up at his.
Yeah, he's had that too. Yeah. Oh, it's fun. All right. Well, listen, you've been very generous with your time. I suppose I should go back to work. But next time I'm in Sweden, I will.
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure. If you're in Västerås, because I'm there a lot. My work is really close.
Yeah. Wonderful to talk to you, mate. Thank you so much. I'll see you soon.
Take care.
Bye. You can rate and review this series on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and that'll help people to find the show. You can also sign up for a midweek newsletter that I've started doing. You can get that at ianfarrell.com/sign-up, and there is a link to it in the show notes as well. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.